Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us.
They call it daylight savings. They said it would help the farmers. They didn't expect it to destroy everything else.
It gets dark so early now.
We gained an hour, but we've lost light.
Wait, didn't we lose an hour?
No, we spring forward, fall back.
They even made a movie about it, our annual rituals of moving our clocks forward or backward by 1 hour. The U.S. Senate recently voted unanimously to stop this and stick with daylight savings time permanently. The legislation now awaits approval in the House, and in the meantime, some think that with the Sunshine Protection Act, as it's called, Congress is abolishing the wrong setting and should instead make standard time permanent. Who's right? Maggie Freeman is a professor of psychology here at Eastern Kentucky University. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Freeman.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And first, if you would, give us your view from a psychological standpoint of this move to make daylight savings time permanent.
Sure. So it's a tricky topic, definitely. You know, we noticed with the time change, I definitely have seen with my clients and then just in the broader literature how that shifts back and forth can take a toll on people. I think people are kind of sick of having to change their clocks. They don't see it as necessary. But then there are the two options of different ways to changing the clocks. And so there's the standard time, and then there's the permanent daylight savings time. And so I guess I'll just talk about briefly the difference between those things. So permanent standard time, it's more following the sun. And so it seems to be more in line with our hormones. It seems to make more sense with the way that our bodies are sort of naturally programmed. And then on the other hand, permanent daylight savings time is seen by some, and we can kind of gather by the title, the Sunshine Protection Act is maybe a way to sneak a couple more daylight hours into our days. And so for me, I guess, you know, reading the literature about the Sunshine Protection Act and having a permanent daylight savings time, it sounds really great. It sounds great on paper, but then the more you look into it, it affects different geological regions differently. And in some states, it could mean that the sun wouldn't rise until 9 o'clock in the morning, and it would really affect just kind of the natural circadian rhythms that our bodies create.
Well, I understand that that is especially a problem for teenagers, the idea of a late morning sunrise, and teenagers who feel like they're waking up for school in the middle of the night, missing most of their REM or their dream sleep, which happens in the early morning hours. Why is REM sleep important to mental health?
Oh, gosh. REM sleep is so important. It helps us really kind of recharge our bodies for the day. It helps us transfer memories into long-term memory. It really just helps our entire body regulate and kind of get back in gear for the next day. REM sleep is one of the most important, I guess, stages of sleep along the way. And especially for developing brains, teenagers really need a solid sleep hygiene schedule and to really be getting a good night's sleep.
Why do we need sunlight in the morning?
Sunlight wakes us up. It makes us feel happy in the morning. It's interesting. I was reading some of the literature from previous years. I guess the Congress decided to try this out in the 1970s, and it didn't go very well. They repealed it pretty quickly. And one of the main reasons for doing so was because kids didn't like waiting outside in the dark for the school bus in the morning. And so, you know, things have changed a little bit since the 70s, but those facts still remain true. Kids are going to be outside in the dark. It's harder to get out and get moving when everything's still dark outside. Teenagers, as you know, can be kind of cranky in the morning. And so the darkness doesn't really help with that. It doesn't help them kind of get in gear and get prepared for their school day. They're going to be a little bit more lethargic, a little bit harder to get going. And that's going to just kind of set them up for a rough day.
It's difficult enough as it is, isn't it?
Right, it is.
You know, I've read that that today's adolescents or teenagers they're already the most sleep-deprived population in human history.
Yes, I believe that.
Yeah, me too. And I wonder, is daylight savings particularly dangerous for them?
You know, That's a great question. I mean, I think it definitely poses some challenges as far as, you know, they are already sleep deprived. They're up all night and they wake up super early for school. And so when you add to that the daylight savings time, that affects their levels of serotonin, it affects their levels of melatonin, and that can really affect mental health, it can affect physical health, and that puts them just in a position where they're not in their prime.
Well, if we take the question of whether or not daylight savings time is good for us or bad for us out of the equation and just talk about time change itself, do you often see increases in cases following a spring or fall time change?
I wouldn't say I would necessarily see an increase in cases, but I could definitely say that I see, you know, out of the cases that I work with, an increase in symptoms during the week or maybe even 2 weeks following that time change.
Mm-hmm. What sorts of mental issues might result from permanent daylight savings time?
I don't know that it necessarily causes any mental illnesses, but it certainly can affect already established mental illnesses. And so if someone's already prone to something like depression or anxiety, that could certainly be affected. We have a diagnosis called seasonal affective depression, and that could definitely be affected too. It's sort of, we hear the winter blues a lot. That's sort of the colloquial term, but it can actually go as far as becoming a diagnosis. And so for people who are maybe more prone or susceptible to that kind of seasonal change in mood, that could follow through into the permanent daylight savings time, dependent on how that affects their particular region.
Well, I haven't heard that this has become yet another hyper-political issue, but it probably will be, given today.
Very well could be.
So I'd like to ask you, just from your professional scholarly perspective, would it make sense to you to instead make standard time permanent instead of daylight savings time?
To me, that makes the most sense. Just from what I've read about it, you know, our bodies follow all of these natural biological cycles. And so standard time does seem to fall more in line with our body's natural rhythm, our circadian rhythm. To me, that makes the most sense.
Maggie Freeman is a professor of psychology at Eastern Kentucky University. Thank you, Dr. Freeman.
Thank you.
Years ago, in 2020, the Markey Cancer Center at UK published The Cancer Crisis in Appalachia, Kentucky Students Take Action. It's a collection of essays written by high school and undergraduate students from Kentucky's Appalachian region who've taken part in the Appalachian Career Training in Oncology, or ACTION, program at the Markey Cancer Center. The ACTION program is publishing a second edition that features more firsthand accounts of growing up in a place with the nation's highest rates of cancer. And here to tell us about this new edition is the director of the ACTION program, Dr. Nathan Vanderford. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Dr. Vanderford.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to be back.
So why is it important to the fight against cancer in Eastern Kentucky to encourage young people from the region to consider careers in oncology?
Yeah, that's a great question, Tom. So as you know, we truly do have a cancer crisis in Appalachian Kentucky. You know, the state continues to be ranked number one in overall cancer incidence and mortality rates. The rates continue to be even higher in Appalachian Kentucky. And so it's critically important that we bring awareness to this fact across the state, and particularly in Eastern Kentucky. And then we are on a mission, and we think it's really important to train the next generation of oncology professionals who are going to tackle the cancer problem in Appalachian Kentucky, and to have those be individuals who were born and raised and have a personal understanding of the issues that the area faces. And who best to do that than the youth of the region?
And, you know, we've talked about that in the past, about why that's especially important. There are distance issues in coming from some parts of southeastern Kentucky all the way up to Lexington, so better to have an oncologist there. And also there is kind of a communications and trust issue, isn't there?
Absolutely. Yeah, so, Tom, as you know, if I think about Pike County, Letcher County, you know, these are 3 hours away, 3 hours plus. It takes me 3.5 hours to get to these beautiful areas of our beautiful state. And, you know, there's a huge barrier in terms of getting patients here. So we definitely need more practitioners in that immediate area to take care of our patients. But also in terms of the trust issue, I think all of us want to be able to connect with the people that take care of us. You know, I think rural Americans, rural people from anywhere, really, and just people groups from all over would like to connect with people that understands who they are, where they come from, why they do the things they do. So I think that's one of the reasons why this program and having the goal of getting these students back to their home areas is so important.
Well, how does this exercise of sitting down and writing an essay help these students? What have you noticed?
Oh, that's a great question. So in this program, you know, we do activities where we get students engaged in cancer research and cancer education activities where we, you know, set them down in a classroom and teach them about cancer in general, from the basic biology of the disease all the way to behavioral aspects and epidemiology, all these things. So they learn a lot. They learn a lot about cancer. They start working on the problem through their research. And then what's been really, I didn't even really envision this happening as much as it has, is when they write these essays, they start to connect the dots between what they're learning, which is a lot about cancer, and what they see in their homes and among their, you know, broader family and in their community. And they start to see the things that we tell them that are driving the high cancer rates in Eastern Kentucky. They see that. They experience it firsthand. And many times we have students, you know, they encounter these things and they think it's normal. And to them, it is normal. But, you know, the high smoking rates and the distance issue to places like Lexington to get the care that's so greatly needed, it's just normal to them. So they really start to, their eyes start to become wide open in terms of what the causes of the crisis really are.
Do you hope to reach an audience beyond Eastern Kentucky? And if you do, why is that important to any success in reducing cancer in the region?
Absolutely. And I think we've done that with the first edition, certainly in Kentucky. I mean, we've had people throughout the state that have become more aware. And actually, we partnered with a group in Chicago, and they have a similar group as ours, and they had their students read our first edition of the book. And so their students are urban students from Chicago, and they read the book, and then we got on a Zoom call during the pandemic with those students, and we had some of our essay authors discuss their personal experiences with the students in Chicago. And it was eye-opening to the students in Chicago to learn about the ruralness of Eastern Kentucky and why it is that cancer is so incredibly bad there. And so I think it's important in terms of spreading the word and helping others understand why we have such a problem. And I think that that can help, as we shine more light on the issues, that can help us hopefully have more attention within Kentucky on the things that we need to do to help solve the problems.
Well, Nathan, I know that you and the editor of the second edition, Chris Pritchard, are going to work to get this book into the hands of people in the region. Tell us more about that.
Absolutely. So we've already given our essay authors multiple copies of the book, and what I've told them is spread these far and wide and freely. We're giving them away for free. So we're having the students, you know, place copies wherever they think is could be impactful, you know, in local libraries, school libraries, wherever else. So we're giving away literally hundreds of copies all across Eastern Kentucky. You know, we'll do what we can to spread it far and wide beyond that also. It's also available for purchase, so, you know, others can buy the book and all the proceeds go back to the Action Program so that we can continue doing programs, projects like this to help the students learn more and connect with the community.
The deadline for undergraduate applications for the Action Program has passed, but high school applicants still have some time until May 13th. How can they apply?
That's right, Tom. We're currently recruiting. We're very excited to be recruiting the next cohorts of our students. So if folks Google Markey Action Program, I think you'll find us near the top, if not the top link, and you can click on that web link, and on our main page there, you can scroll down, I think about halfway down the page, and you'll find links to the applications. And we're on a mission to recruit the next cohort of students. We currently have 29 of the 54 Appalachian counties represented in terms of students we've engaged. And it's my goal over the next 5 years or so to have students from every single Appalachian county represented in the program. And so we'd love as many applications as we possibly can get, and we look forward to recruiting and engaging our next group of fantastic high school students.
Well, Nathan, I know the answer to this next question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Tell us about how you have found this work so rewarding.
Yeah, it's very rewarding. I mean, I became really passionate about cancer and cancer disparities when I lost my dad to cancer. He died of lung cancer in 2010. And then just shortly thereafter, my mom was diagnosed with breast cancer. And luckily, she was diagnosed early and went through some successful treatment, and she's okay today. So from a personal perspective, and again, I'm from rural Appalachia, so many of the issues I have seen in my own family. So I'm deeply passionate about this work because of that. But in general, I just absolutely love working with students. It's just so exciting to work with students in general, and particularly students from Eastern Kentucky. We have amazing students in the state. They just need opportunities, you know. In many of these rural areas, there's fewer opportunities, outstanding students, and they can just excel when given opportunities like this to take the ball and run with it, so to speak.
All right, that's Dr. Nathan Vandiver, director of the Appalachian Career Training in Oncology, or ACTION program, at the University of Kentucky's Markey Cancer Center. Thank you, Dr. Vandiver.
Thank you, Tom. Always great to talk to you.
When crisis strikes, there is a premium on clear, reliable information. Dr. Melanie Schemberger is an associate professor of journalism and mass communication at Murray State University. Her primary research interests include crisis communication. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Dr. Schemberger.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
So let's begin by laying out for our listeners, what is crisis management? What are the types of crisis management?
Sure. Crisis management actually goes by different terms. Sometimes we refer to it as risk management or even issues management. But really what we're talking about with crisis, it could be anything. It could be a natural disaster. It can be an issue that really might not be planned for at all. Something arises and it could present some sort of detriment to the reputation of an organization. It can also just be a risk that might be anticipated, but it can be controlled. So there are different kinds, but they all still follow a similar pattern in what we're trying to deal with, which is trying to minimize. And that when it comes to crisis management, communication is a big key to helping in managing and minimizing the crisis.
Well, I understand that there are five phases of a crisis. Is that the way that it's broken down? Does that resonate with you?
Pretty much. It's a good way to study crisis management. It starts with signal detection. This is pretty much where the warning signs are evident. And then we begin into the second part, probing and prevention. We're trying to investigate it more. So that way we can move into the third, containing any damage that or any type of threat that might be occurring. And then hopefully once we can emerge from that, we're in a period of recovery, and then hopefully some opportunities to learn some lessons and how we can move forward. Now, those are the big five stages. Doesn't mean that they all follow that seamlessly. And sometimes they can all occur simultaneously. But those are the big stages that we do recognize and that scholars over time have really seen in different crisis events.
Well, there's been this kind of mantra out there telling people, do your research, without any real guidance on what exactly that means and what is legitimate research. For listeners who might be confused about that, can you clarify what represents good research that yields solid information?
Sure. One of the things that I teach often to students as well as to family members is don't rely on just one source. If you look at news, you know, I'm not going to advocate for one news source over another, but one of the things that I show students what to do, go to the About section on a website of a news organization. They should be able to tell you if they side with one influence. If they are of a certain political influence, that's a red flag. I'm not saying you can't follow along that news. I'm not saying that at all. But I think a healthy news diet, especially in the context we are in today with a pandemic, you really need to vary your sources of information. There are several different methods that even our colleagues in library science go through. One method is called the CRAAP method, C-R-A-A-P. It really guides a person through in selecting that credible information. But the big thing I can suggest right now, vary your sources.
I think I just heard 1,000 fingers on keyboards out there typing in C-R-A-A-P. Is that correct?
That is correct, C-R-A-A-P.
All right, that's Melanie Schemberger, Associate Professor of Journalism and Mass Communication at Murray State University. Thanks, Dr. Schemberger.
Thank you so much.
A clarification concerning last week's segment on heirs' properties. In explaining a lack of safeguards in Kentucky against heirs' property land parcels being leased to coal companies and other extractive interests over the objections of other people holding an ownership interest in those properties, Carson Benn of LIKEN, the Livelihoods Knowledge Education Network, says he did not intend to leave listeners with the impression that they have no recourse. Landowners facing the prospect of property being mined over their objection, based on a lease made by another owner of the property, should consult an attorney regarding their rights under Kentucky's common law and state constitution, because Kentucky law on the matter is not settled. We thank Tom Fitzgerald of the Kentucky Resources Council for catching this and calling our attention to it. Coming up after the break, an emerging Kentucky novelist shares his work and how the George Ella Lyon poem, Where I'm From, is serving as a healing tool for troubled students.
I am from poverty.
And prison inmates.
It gives them the opportunity to say, this is my story.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Major support for WEKU comes from Kentucky's Touchstone Energy Cooperatives, supplying reliable power and energy usage information to co-op members. Co-ops offer an online energy assessment to help evaluate energy usage. More information is available at your local co-op's virtual energy assessment link.
WEKU is supported by Hicks and Funson. Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Mitch Whitaker provide legal representation for car and truck accidents and other personal injury matters. More information at 859-777-7000.
Eastern Standard continues with Tom Martin.
One of the many things that we love to do on this program is to spotlight emerging Kentucky talent. Here's one now, talking with Kevin Nance, a contributor to the online arts magazine Undermain.art.
So our guest on Eastern Standard today is Lee Cole, who is a young writer from Western Kentucky who's written a novel called Groundskeeping. It's out from Knopf, a very prestigious New York publisher. He has some excellent advance praise from literary lights like Richard Russo and Ann Patchett. He's a graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and he's written a very lovely novel kind of a coming of age story about a young guy who has moved to Louisville after having grown up in Western Kentucky. And he meets a young woman there named Alma who asks him, among other things, where he's from. And he answers and she starts collecting some things what she thinks of as quirky things in the way he phrases it. And I see, Lee, first of all, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
I see that you're from, according to your bio, from rural Kentucky, and that your character in the book, Owen, says at one point, and she kind of jots this down, where at? So that's what I'm going to ask you. Where at exactly are you from rural Kentucky?
Well, it's I usually tell people just near Paducah, but truthfully, I grew up close to the Graves County line, kind of like Owen. I grew up close to this little town called Melber that's on the Graves County line.
Which is actually mentioned in the book. Are you Owen, Lee?
No, I don't think that I am. I mean, I certainly share some biographical details with Owen, but I tried to make him misbehave in ways that that I wouldn't. And I think I gave him more bitterness than I have, or more resentment. I think his feelings about Kentucky are complicated, to say the least. And it's a place that he has this attraction to, but also this aversion to.
Along that line, Lee, let's go ahead and have you read from the very beginning of the novel. I think it will introduce both the novel and the very topic you're describing.
Yeah, that sounds great. I'll just start from the beginning. I've always had the same predicament. When I'm home in Kentucky, all I want is to leave. When I'm away, I'm homesick for a place that never was. This is what I told Alma the night we met. A grad student had thrown a party, and we'd both gone. I don't know how long we'd been talking or how the conversation started, but I'd seen her watching me. That's why I went over. She was watching me like I might try to steal something from her. What does that mean, a place that never was, she said. All around us, people were talking in groups of twos and threes. It was a house way out in the country, decorated in the way you'd expect of a grad student, someone with an overdeveloped sense of irony and curation, who also happened to be broke. Foreign film posters, a lamp made from antlers with a buckskin shade, those Chili Pepper Christmas lights. We were standing in the pink glow of a Wurlitzer jukebox. In her right hand, she held a solo cup and an unlit cigarette. Her long denim skirt was of the kind I associated with Pentecostal. On the other side of the Wurlitzer stood a life-size cardboard cutout of Walt Whitman, the one where he's got his hat cocked and his fist on his hip. I kept catching sight of him in my periphery and thinking it was another person standing there, eavesdropping. I don't know what I'm talking about, I said. I'm a little drunk.
Now, of course, you've never been drunk, I'm sure.
No, yeah, purely fictional. Yeah.
There's a moment fairly early on where Owen is telling Alma about his early short stories, and he says they were set in Westchester. And she says, why in Westchester? And why did you set them there? And Owen says, because I didn't want people to know where I'm from, which is a very sad line. How does that reflect your own experience as a writer? Did you write things early on that were said in other places? And did you have to kind of go through a process to write about Kentucky?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think starting out, you go out and you start reading books, and there aren't a lot of books set in Kentucky, at least that I was finding when I was in college. And they all seem to be set in these kind of upper middle class places or in exotic places like Europe or something like that, you know. And so for a long time, I thought that's what I had to do to be a writer. I thought, well, I have to write stories that are set in, for example, Westchester, which is where, John Cheever set all of his kind of suburban upper middle class stories. But at a certain point, I think it's just kind of about finding your voice as a writer. I realized that that the uniqueness of coming from Kentucky and being able to write about that place was valuable, and that it would make my voice unique and that I'd be contributing something that wasn't so common. And so at a certain point, I kind of embraced that. And now I think almost everything I write is set in Kentucky.
There is, in this relationship with Alma, a kind of growth. Of course, there's a romance that happens, but she's already connected to another person. So there's a bit of a love triangle kind of a situation. What does Alma mean to Owen? And I don't mean to pry, but, you know, have you had this experience of that you base this story on at all, falling in love with somebody who was already attached?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people have some experience with that, or maybe falling in love with somebody who's not available at the moment, you know, or they're with somebody else, which can be, I guess, just the experience of unrequited love. But, you know, Alma was sort of, a composite character. I wasn't basing her on any one particular person. It was just sort of based on, you know, several experiences that I've had. And then a lot of that was just, a lot of her character was just fabricated completely. But I think for Owen, she's just this representation of the unfamiliar. You know, he and Alma are very different, but what they have in common is that they both have this kind of longing for the unfamiliar. And for Owen, it's this longing to kind of escape and to get out and see the world. And for Alma, it's almost this longing to settle down. For her, Kentucky is almost this exotic place, and she's never been there, and she likes it and, you know, ends up wanting to stay. So, you know, and I think Alma being the daughter of immigrants too, there is a thematic resonance there because the novel is set during the 2016 election. And, you know, a lot of Donald Trump's ire during that time was directed toward people like Alma. So it really raises the stakes for her, the election, and it raises the stakes for her when she's meeting Owen's family, too, I think.
There's another way that comes out earlier in the book. In fact, Owen lives, we should say, in his grandfather's basement. And his grandfather, also living with his grandfather, is, I guess, his wife's brother, whose name is Court, right? And he comes home one day, Owen does, and sees that there is a Make America Great Again sign posted in the window. And he kind of goes a little off the rails on that. The point is, it's part of what the worlds he's moving in between, Owen, is sort of the world of conservative, rural America and the sophisticates, people like Casey, Alma's boyfriend, who lives in a fabulous house in old Louisville and drops names like Lydia Davis and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, he's kind of, you're right, he's almost got whiplash, sort of oscillating between these two worlds. And of course, he's also working as a groundskeeper on this college campus. So he's around, you know, his kind of working class coworkers, one of which is also voting for Trump or supporting Trump, I guess. But, you know, I wanted to write about that time and Owen seeing that sign in the window that his uncle puts up. I mean, there's a lot there. I think that he's thinking about this kind of illusion of nostalgia. And that's something that comes up again and again in the book. At one point, he and Alma go to a Cracker Barrel. There's a scene set in a Cracker Barrel. And I sort of think of Cracker Barrel as being a commodified version of that nostalgia, where these agrarian tools of the past are sort of literally kind of affixed to the walls. And, you know, I think that that's something that Owen's thinking a lot about home and what it means to him and whether his longing for that home is legitimate or whether he's sort of falling into what he sees as sort of the trap of Trumpism, kind of this mythologized past or longing. Yeah. Having this nostalgia for something that's not real.
There's a lot of specifics in the books, product names, names of stores, bars, streets, neighborhoods, songs, pop songs, which reminds me a little bit of the early work of another writer from Western Kentucky, Bobby Ann Mason, and I wondered if she is in any way an inspiration for you in this novel.
Oh, absolutely. I love Bobby Ann Mason, and her work was really, really important to me. Just in, you know, like I mentioned earlier, kind of finding my voice and feeling like I had permission to write about Kentucky, reading her work, I guess reading her and Wendell Berry as well, sort of made me realize that, you know, it was possible that I could write about the towns that I knew so well and the people that I knew so well growing up in Western Kentucky. And, you know, you're right. She was writing about a time kind of when, in the 80s, especially when the agrarian South was sort of confronting this new era of Walmarts and shopping malls and strip malls and all of that. And so there's a kind of strangeness to those brand names and, you know, the names of films and songs and stuff that are entering that world. And so that was definitely an influence for me. I think her work has been really important.
You do something stylistically that's kind of interesting. I assume that it's a sort of lineage question, perhaps, but it's the absence of quotation marks around dialogue. Why no quote marks?
Well, you know, it's partly just because a lot of the books I was reading at the time I was writing it weren't using quotation marks. And but it's also, I think, because there are long stretches of dialogue in the book, especially between Owen and Alma when they're meeting and kind of walking around and getting to know each other. And it's just sort of back and forth, and it's only two people, you know. And so I felt like adding in, I feel like for one thing, they maybe weren't necessary in those scenes, that the reader would be able to tell well enough who was talking. And second, in these long stretches of dialogue, you know, I thought that they might kind of clutter the page a little bit, that it might look a little messy to me. But ultimately, it's just kind of a subjective choice or a matter of a preference, I think, on my part.
Well, congratulations on the book, Lee, and best of luck to you. What's next for you in your work as a writer?
Well, I'm, you know, promoting this now, but I've started on another project, and maybe it's the pandemic, but I've been thinking a lot about this topic of doomsday preppers. So I've been thinking about writing a project sort of along those lines about people who believe that the end is nigh and who are kind of preparing for it. So that's
also set in Kentucky, perhaps?
Also set in Kentucky, yeah.
Okay, well, we'll keep an eye out for that one. Thank you, Lee, for being with us.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Thanks to Kevin Nance for his conversation with Lee Cole, author of Groundskeeper. It's one of the hardest working poems ever penned by a Kentucky writer, Where I'm From by George Ella Lyon. And we have two examples of how poetry, and this poem in particular, has made a real difference in the lives of people. With us now from the Learning Center in Lexington is Eric Little. He teaches 10th and 11th grade English, and a group of his students have done something extraordinary that we want to share with you. Thanks for joining us, Eric.
Well, thanks for having me.
And to give our listeners some context, tell us briefly about the Learning Center.
So the Learning Center is an alternative school in Lexington that we thrive with kids who just don't do well with traditional schooling. They might have some anxiety issues or some truancy issues. We have a lot of LGBTQ kids that come to us. We are just sort of a bastion for kids who don't do well and who need that sort of social and emotional learning component to their day, that we build relationships with them. We really care for and love these kids, and that's sort of our mission.
Well, tell us how this project came about and what we're about to hear.
So George Ella Lyons actually went to school with my father and mother at Center College years ago, and she is a poet that I've loved. She wrote a poem called Where I'm From, and it is an identity poem about herself and her coming of age. And so I wanted to challenge my kids to write about themselves. Poetry is a scary thing sometimes. And to have a template like the Where I'm From poem by George Ella Lyons really gives us a good starting point to learn some really extraordinary stories from our kids, and we get to know them better, and they get to be proud of what they wrote, and it's a really just been a fantastic experience for us.
Well, Eric, we asked Georgella Lyon to read her poem, Where I'm From, so that our listeners can understand the basis of your students' works. Let's listen to that.
Where I'm From. I'm from clothespins, from Clorox and carbon tetrachloride. I'm from the dirt under the back porch, black, glistening. It tasted like beets. I am from the forsythia bush, the Dutch elm, whose long gone limbs I remember as if they were my own. I'm from fudge and eyeglasses, from Imogene and Allifair. I'm from the know-it-alls and the pass-it-on, from perk up and pipe down. I'm from He Restoreth My Soul with a cotton ball lamb and 10 verses I can say myself. I'm from Artemis and Billy's Branch, fried corn and strong coffee, from the finger my grandfather lost to the auger, the eye my father shut to keep his sight. Under my bed was a dress box filling old pictures, a sift of lost faces to drift beneath my dreams. I am from those moments, snapped before I budded, leaf fall from the family tree.
Okay, let's bring your students to the phone one by one to read their versions of Where I'm From.
My name is Isaiah Duty, and this is my poem. I am from poverty, from cloth diapers and off-brand Cheetos. I am from the mountainside trees, dark and cold. I am from dandelions, the smell of sweet filled the air. I'm from Goodwill and thrift stores, from Stephanie and Danny. I'm from discount shopping and God's food pantry, from Not Right Now and Go to Your Room. I'm from Christianity, White Oak Baptist Church. I'm from Somerset, Kentucky, cornbread and meatloaf, from caring motherly love and neglect of a dad.
Hi, I'm Denise Shackman. I am from Mott's Apple Juice, from Legos and Scooters. I am from the red brick fishbowl on the hill, old, safe, and welcoming. I am from the sunflowers from the patch across the street. I am from Sunday's breakfast for dinner and Halloween parties, from Mark and Laura. I'm from the calm down room and nap time, from What's the Worst That Could Happen? To Why Quit When You Have Unlimited Chances. I am from Services Every Friday Night. I'm from Randolph, New Jersey. I am from Latkes and Matzo Ball Soup. Family Pictures in the Living Room. From the New Jersey Accent. I am from the ceramic baby shoe I got when I was born from the hospital.
Hi, my name's Ava Fields. I am from in and out of foster homes, from the feeling of loneliness, from drugs and abuse. I am from the cold four walls of my room. I am from the smell of cold, chilly mornings. I'm from wanting more and not being good enough. From my sister Zoe. I'm from an unloving family, from being told I will never be enough, from good times and bad. I'm from no one special, from not having enough food to eat. I am from the desire of someone to love me, from protecting my sister with all I got, from envying other families. I am from recovery.
Hey, I'm Olivia Davis. Black beautiful girl, did I mention she was very beautiful? She never thought she was beautiful, but she was. Everybody made her feel ugly and disgusted with herself. Grew up hating life, and not only life, but herself. Her family and friends didn't make it any better. They broke her down even more. The girl didn't understand why everybody was the way they were to her. She was hurting inside. Felt like she was burning, felt like she didn't have anybody. Nightmares she would have. Wake up screaming and crying for her grandparents. Only people who made her feel at home were her grandparents. The girl was just broken, didn't want to be at school. She didn't even want to be at her house, but she had no choice. Stayed in her room. She knew nobody was going to have her back like she did. She finally cut people off and defended herself. Has her guard up because everybody tries to come in and hurt her. If you really know her, you would know she is strong. Been broken a million times, but never let it hurt her to the point where she couldn't keep going. Broken girl, broken soul, who's just trying to live in this broken world. Black, beautiful girls, don't let this world eat you up. People want to see you lose. That's why you got to keep going.
Hello, my name is Damaris Lopez, and today I'm going to read my poem. I am from the shadows, from a dark and spooky alley. I am from the basement, the sad, lonely silence. I am from the roots of a dying, dangling rose. I am from building and wrecking, from Cortez and Netherin. I am from running and escaping consequence and problem. I am from Nogatki. I am from Phoenix, Arizona, the hot, sunny weather, from chilling at the lake to looking at the diamond stars at night, to standing on top of the Grand Canyon to see the sun meet the horizon. This is my poem.
I'm Madeline Knight, and this is my poem. I am from the old dusty bookstore where my mother used to work, from Calico Critters and Studio Ghibli Films. I am from the room I shared with my brother, small, crowded, sunlight pouring in through the windows. I'm from the columbines outside my window that the hummingbirds drink from in the spring. I'm from cemetery walks and green eyes, from Brandon and Jen, from kitchen haircuts and sarcastic jokes, from stop being so shy and don't worry so much, from finding truth in all religions and learning from the world around me. I'm from Lexington, Kentucky via Italy, mulberries and fresh strawberries, from the beach trip with my cousins, summertime bike rides with my mother, the Afghan that sits on my bed, knitted by my great-grandmother, handed down three generations to always remind me where I'm from.
Students in Eric Little's English class at the Learning Center in Lexington with their versions of the George Ella Lyon poem, Where I'm From, which has also found its way into a prison, as we hear from Bill McCann's guest in his series on theater in Kentucky.
I'm talking today with Robbie Henson, who is the artistic director of Pioneer Playhouse and the program director of a program called Voices Inside, which is Pioneer Playhouse's prison outreach program. So thank you for joining us, Robbie.
Bill, it's great to be here. Thanks for giving a shout-out.
We just heard some students read their poems based on George Ella Lyon's Where I'm From, and you've used the same prompt with some of your Voices Inside students, haven't you?
I have. I've heard of Ms. Lyon's prompt. Ours is called I Come From, and it was introduced into our program by one of our volunteers in Louisville who worked with our program, and it's a writing exercise. You know, it's one of the opening exercises we do in our program where we have each incarcerated writer create a declaration poem about who they are. I come from Louisville. I come from eating hamburgers and cheeseburgers. You know, you kind of fill in the blank of, you know, things that you like, things that about yourself you like, things about yourself you don't like. And at the end of these six or seven prompts in the poem exercise, it comes up with a declaration of self.
Why does Pioneer Playhouse, which produces summer productions of light comedies, Under the Stars, do a prison outreach?
I think every theater tries to figure out ways to perhaps be more relevant to their community. And, about 11 years ago, we had a brainstorming session trying to figure out, well, who is our community? And of course, our community, Bill, as you know, our patrons that come to our comedies and our outdoor summer stock theater productions. But we decided to say, well, perhaps our community is also some guys in a medium security prison that are 8 miles away from our theater. And we're going to consider them part of our community. And we decided to do an outreach into that community. And we called our program Voices Inside. And the warden at the time was very open to us coming in and doing a writing and performance series of classes with the incarcerated.
What are the challenges of doing theater in a prison?
You know, sometimes you can be in the middle of a class and there's a lockdown and you can't leave for 2 hours. You know, so there's a few challenges, mainly the ones that deal with that you have to go behind the razor wire and you have to get searched, and there's certain things you can bring in, and all of those things which we understand. Those are some of the challenges. The benefits have been huge, and I actually think that we who work in the program get more out of it than perhaps the incarcerated writers, in that we feel that we are kind of Johnny Appleseeds of art. We're kind of sowing these creative seeds that might bear fruit, and those we serve might learn to use creativity in a positive way. It may raise their self-esteem. It may increase their communication skills. It may promote a feeling of empathy when they read each other's work and, you know, and perform each other's work. And we feel like it connects them with the human spirit. So we feel like we're kind of Johnny Appleseeds, and we get, those of us who work in the program get a lot out of that. We really do.
And how do the actors, the performers, the writers, what do they get out of it?
You know, nobody has really told them that their personal story is worth listening to. You know, maybe prosecutors may have told their story. Maybe judges, maybe, you know, law enforcement individuals have said, this is who you are. And I think it gives them the opportunity to say, this is my story. This is my play. This is my creative work of art. And then we do it in a circle where the creative work is applauded. And I think that brings self-esteem. As I said, it raises communication skills. And I think being creative is a wonderful thing. And our incarcerated writers start to value that.
And then does Pioneer Playhouse also perform there?
Yeah, we, you know, Bill, there has been a COVID pandemic that has restricted some of the volunteerism behind bars that we do. We have sort of transitioned into email mentoring. But, you know, when our program was running strong pre-COVID, and we hope soon post-COVID, we do bring our Playhouse actors in, and we usually do one of the main stage productions that our audiences have enjoyed in the summer on our main stage at Pioneer Playhouse. We will bring that production in behind bars to North Point and perform it for the general adult prison population. And several of the, in the past, several of the inmates who have seen those shows have said, you know, this is the first live play with live actors I've ever seen in my life. And, you know, we're like, wow, that's, you know, we're, you know, some of our actors say that's why we do theater.
What about the impact on the families of the incarcerated? Does it impact them?
You know, some of the longtime members of our program, you know, we know their grandmothers, and, you know, because they'll be in touch. And oftentimes, Bill, the plays that our incarcerated writers write get performed outside the bars by, like, you run a Kentucky Theater Association a play festival. Several of our incarcerated writers have had plays selected and put online by you. And so, you know, relatives of the incarcerated writers get to see the works, you know, performed. And that's a good thing, which you, Bill, have been a part of with your Kentucky Theater Association play festivals.
That's Robbie Henson, Artistic Director of Pioneer Playhouse and Program Director of Voices Inside, Pioneer Playhouse's prison outreach program. Thank you for joining us, Robbie.
Thank you.
Eastern Standard Theater contributor Bill McCann with Pioneer Playhouse Artistic Director Robbie Henson. That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. You can find us online at weku.org or esweku.org, and on the WEKU app, NPR One, and the Google News app. Want to suggest a topic? Drop us a line at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.